There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
All right, ladies and gents, welcome to episode 53 of Stoke the Fire. We're going to jump into the podcast momentarily. Before we do, this is just a little introduction to say thank you to everybody who is already supporting us via the Patreon page, which we launched at the start of series two. patreon.com/StokeTheFire. That is the place, essentially, where, how would we break it down, Jesse, if it was a pie chart? 60% of the Stoke the Fire activity, pretty much, yeah, going forward, would exist over there. Maybe 40% less so now out here in the, you know, the internet. But Patreon, for those who already know, is definitely the home of the majority of our content going forward, and that's where we get a little bit deeper and take people kind of more behind the scenes of what we do, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say probably even more than 60. It just the vibe of it as well just feels like community, and it there's a lot going on in the comments that I think are just moving this whole show, or whatever you want to call it. It's kind of bigger than a podcast now because of that, and it's definitely been incredible, and we're super grateful for everybody. And it's kind of taken a life of its own on, you know, people are becoming friends on there, and it's just a whole, again, a whole community that's spawned out of this.
Yeah. When we started the show, we did always say this is going to be more than a podcast. And then, as I think you've already mentioned, it did kind of then just become a podcast. And so what we're really now trying to do is just do a podcast, which people get on YouTube and iTunes and Spotify, wherever you're listening to this from. And then Patreon is where the actual vision for Stoke the Fire is happening. And a lot of that, as you alluded to there, has got more to do with the community that are driving it than with even ourselves, because there's friendships, as you say, taking place there. There's also discussions that we're not even always in on or privy to on the Discord page, especially. And that is just such a wonderful and amazing thing that people are just on there connecting without anything to do with anything we're saying. It's just taken on this whole other momentum and life of its own.
Yeah, and we do a Zoom hangout as well. And on that Zoom hangout, it was mentioned that, you know, they just see it differently. It's become something that friendships are being bred. Somebody even was able to reach out and say, I'm not okay. And there was a whole discussion group around that on the Discord. So this has become what we thought it was going to be, and it's happened quite quickly. And I think all of that has to do with the Patreon page. It's been massive in the shift and the growth of this show.
Yeah, and in the interest of total transparency as well, it is a very valuable tool for us. Now we're a completely independent show, to help us finance and fund the making of Stoke the Fire. There's maintenance fees to be paid. There's the producer's fees, which we now have to pay ourselves. Now we're no longer with the network. So by supporting us over there, you are quite literally enabling us to make this podcast. And we did a little update a few episodes ago where we shouted out the people who'd already signed up then. And because of that initial wave of subscribers, we were able to relaunch the podcast and, you know, get everything going with series two. So there's a few more names we want to mention here of the latest subscribers and Patreons. So let's give them some love now. Do you want to go first with the first name, Jesse, and then we'll tag team it once again?
All right. Big thanks to Nathan, in quotes, Rex Madrid. Thank you so much for your support, Nathan.
And thank you to Sarah R. as well.
All right. Ferlin Key. We appreciate you. Thank you for stoking the flames.
And Simon Atkinson, thank you ever so much to you, my friend.
Again, Tom Miles, appreciate you, brother. Firestarter right here. Love it.
Yeah, so we have different names that are themed around different fire puns for each tier on Patreon, so you can check those out. We've got Up in Smoke, Warm as Toast, Campfire Crew, lots of, there's five different tiers in total.
Maybe Warm as Toast.
Yeah, Warm as Toast is the one. It even makes you feel cozy, doesn't it, hearing it? But I think there's actually six tiers, but if you go over there and have an investigate for yourself, you'll be able to see. Thank you as well. Big ups to Joseph Ells for your support.
Matthew Gildermeyer.
Killed it with that name. I would have messed that one up. Thank you, Matthew. Big shout out to Tim Keeling as well.
Big love to Lorna Park.
And we have Alison McNamara. Thank you ever so much to you for stoking the flames.
Yes. Johnny Schumer.
And Alan Davidson. Big up and mercy Boku to you.
Big thanks to Justin Steven.
Then we have the legendary one in words and one numerically. So if ever there was one, this is the one, the legendary one. Thanks to the legendary one for your support.
And big thanks to Dick Tyner.
And finally, last but never least, Michael or Michelle. No, it is Michael. It's Michael Hall or Hell. I know this name because I think he follows me on Instagram, and I believe he was a Life in the Stocks patron. And I had the exact same problem last time trying to read out the name. So ever so sorry, Michael Hell. Let's just say Hell. That's a cool sounding name. It's Michael Hell. But yeah, patreon.com/ Stoke the Fire. That is the place to go. On there, you'll find bonus podcasts, an assorted array of audio and visual delights. And then there's all kinds of behind the scenes access that you just won't get anywhere else, not on social media, not in the podcasts that go out publicly. They exist solely and exclusively on Patreon. Things like the Zoom hangs, which Jesse mentioned. There's the every now and again playlist that we share, both from our guests and also Jesse and myself. You can sit in on interviews. That's one of the things that we offer for one of the higher tiers. The Discord chat as well, which is exclusively available to patrons of the show. And Jesse, just before we get into the podcast, you're about to go on tour, aren't you? So how do you feel about dropping the occasional tour diary and putting that up on the Patreon page?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've actually started something I'm going to continue doing called the Tao of Jesse, where I just come on and talk about certain topics that matter to me, things that are on my mind currently. So I can certainly drop in little tour updates as well, exclusively for our Patreon subscribers. No problem.
Amazing. Well, once again, that address is patreon.com/ Stoke the Fire. If you love this show, if you get something positive out of it, if you want to show your support and allow us to continue making it, but also you want to become a part of the inner circle, the Campfire Crew, get to make a whole new bunch of friends and see what goes on behind the scenes and just learn so much more about everything that goes into this show, then that is the place to go. And we thank you in advance for your time and your support with that. But without further ado, let's jump into episode 53 of Stoke the Fire with entrepreneur, an executive, and just a genuinely brilliant mind, right, Jesse? Keeve Huffman joins us for this one. And what a great chat it is.
Oh, yeah, I love it. It's a great talk, man. Very interesting. Let's do it, my friends.
People can change anything they want to. And that means everything in the world. Show me any country, and there'll be people in it. It's time to take the humanity back into the center of the ring and follow that for a time. Think on that. Without people, you're nothing. Without people, you're nothing.
Stoke the fire.
It's a hot one today, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it is whilst we record. By the time this goes out, it might no longer be, or it might even be hotter. I mean, it can't get hotter than this.
Where I am here in upstate New York, it's rainy and chilly, which is kind of nice.
That for me sounds like heaven right now, Jesse. As you can see from the shirt, if you're watching this, ladies and gentlemen, it is summertime here in the UK, and you know what that means. We all get sunburned and moan about the heat. That's how we like to do it in jolly old England. It's funny, man. The news at the moment is like just a fear-mongering kind of public health warning cycle of just stay hydrated, don't go outside. It's like it's hot, but it's not Africa hot.
Wow, so the news is fear-mongering. I've never heard of that. That's crazy. What a weird, shocking turn of events.
It's unusual, isn't it?
Yes.
Especially nowadays, especially yeah. nowadays. I can't really think why that is. But anyway, welcome to another edition of Stoke the Fire, ladies and gentlemen. This one is a very special one. It's a little bit different, I think, to anything we've done to date. But it is going to incorporate, I think, themes, topics, and discussions that we have delved into at various points throughout the, you know, the longevity of this show so far. And I mean, a man with many different strands to his bow and different chapters to his story as well. So without further ado, let's welcome him onto the show. Keeve Huffman joins us, raconteur, businessman, and kind of a genius and a visionary in many ways. Welcome to the show, Keeve. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for the kind intro. Great to be here, guys.
So Jesse, like we always do, I think we want a bit of background, don't we? A little bit of kind of story, journey to date. Contextualizing and you know information, I think, so we can begin the conversation there. So Keeve, before we get into the amazing work that you do, could we get a little bit of background on yourself, perhaps where you grew up, growing up, what your passions and interests were, and maybe what led you into, was it the music industry first before marketing and branding? Was music always kind of the guiding light for you?
Yeah, always music. My mother was a musician. She played the flute, actually. And so I grew up around music all the time. I just was always a huge music fan growing up. And then when I went away to college, I started getting into promoting concerts and bands. And I worked at college radio station. And started just throwing parties and having my friends' bands play. And also right around that time, I was always looking for ways to supplement my income getting through college. And I had a good friend. I went to school at the University of Michigan in Michigan. And I had a good buddy from high school down in Arizona. And he would send me paint cans full of really nice green, you know, flower. And so kind of early on, I was kind of bringing together all the worlds that kind of I'm working in now, which is sort of this combination of music and cannabis.
Amazing. Can we ask you a quick favor before we go any further? I think the microphone you have on is perhaps either rubbing on your shirt or your beard. That might be annoying. I mean, is it annoying for you if you just don't have headphones and just go with the computer speaker and mic?
We can certainly do that, although I'm in a group office, so you guys tell me if it's okay.
How is that?
Oh yeah, no, the headphones is definitely the way to go. Yeah. This might be a little bit annoying, mate. Sorry, but if you wouldn't mind kind of either perhaps holding it like that or just, you know, kind of sitting in a fairly stationary position. We'll get there.
Okay. So, no, how is that? Is that better?
That's perfect. I think as long as it's not contacting the shirt or the chin. Yeah. And hopefully that's not too unnatural.
I'll get it figured out. You know, maybe I just need to kind of lean so that it's,
yeah, that'll work.
It's dangling versus
there you
holding.
Go.
So there we go.
I wanted to go back to what you said about the can of paint. So you're talking like one of those old school, like it looks like a can of paint. And you unscrew it and you put the flower in there and you screw it back up, kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's amazing. That brings me back to shampoo, shaving cream. Like that's funny. Back when it was a dangerous game, really, to do that kind of stuff.
It was, I mean, it wasn't that dangerous in Ann Arbor, Michigan, really, to be honest, because like literally at that time, it was like a $5 fine to get caught smoking weed in town. Ann Arbor was always one of the more progressive kind of towns, you know, when it came to the Midwest with respect to weed and kind of any drugs. It was actually worse to get caught with drinking beer. Like they actually cracked down much harder on beer than weed, which I'm a supporter of, actually. You know, it's like much worse things tend to happen from, you know, people drinking, you know, copious amounts of alcohol versus smoking copious amounts of weed. But yeah. So it was like, that was kind of dating myself. That was sort of the way that it used to happen back then. Yeah.
I'm very aware of that. I was very much involved with that type of behavior as well when I was younger, moving weight, as they'd say, when I was younger, just to afford my own copious amounts of ingestion of the herb, which I don't do much anymore. I'm very sort of, we'll get to this later, but I just love the imagery. When you said that, I just brought me back to a time, the 90s especially. It's a very interesting time for that. So Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan, I've actually DJed there. I've done some traveling around Michigan, and it is a fairly sort of progressive mind state that's going on in that area. I had no idea about the leniency, though, back then, especially. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do have this thing called the hash bash that's been a tradition there, and it kind of goes all the way back to the late 60s.
Is Ann Arbor where the Stooges are from?
The Stooges are from Ypsilanti, but they kind of claim to be, which is right next door to, here's a totally random kind of side note.
We live for stuff like this. Lay it on us.
I had a short stint fronting a punk rock cover band. And we played a party once, and we were the opening act for this group called Borax. And the lead singer of Borax was Iggy Pop's nephew. And so anyway, that's my, they're from that whole part of Iggy and the Stooges. They're from that whole Ypsilanti, Ann Arbor, suburban Detroit area. So yeah.
Love it. Iggy Pop, what a legend. To this day, one of the last remaining real rock stars alive. Guy's a total legend.
He's been an inspiration to me. I mean, I used to actually live not too far from him. I lived in the East Village when I first moved out of Michigan and he lived in this building called the Christodora House. It was the first kind of quote unquote luxury building in Alphabet City in the Lower East Side. And I used to always think that I would eventually run into him. Unfortunately, I never did. But nonetheless, I've had the good fortune of seeing him several times live. And he's just an amazing performer, man. That guy, like the energy and just what he brings to the table. And I think he's also in the history of kind of rock and roll and just punk rock, or just kind of in general, just a very underrated songwriter. Just penned some incredible, songs over the years.
Well, now that we're talking about people like Iggy, doing a little bit of research on you, not a ton, because I like to sort of be a little ignorant when I go into these, but you met Joe Strummer as well. And Joe Strummer is a hero of mine. I actually have him tattooed on my forearm right here. The Clash played a huge role in my shaping as a young punk and a lyricist. And one of the reasons I do anything I do is directly linked to Joe Strummer. So tell me about that, because you were in a time frame in an area of the world during a sort of magical time, Alphabet City, East Village, still my favorite part of New York City, even though it's changed. So tell me about Joe Strummer. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, great story. Well, huge influence on me as well. I mean, the first concert I ever remember going to, I actually saw The Clash open for The Who in the Silver Dome in Detroit, suburban Detroit. But yeah, I was living in Alphabet City in the 90s, and I was at a bar on 7th and B. It was called the Horseshoe Bar. And it was definitely a locals bar, and we were there. I went in. I was happened to have my brother-in-law and my sister were in town from Chicago, and my brother-in-law was a huge Clash fan as well, but you would never know it because he dressed really preppy, and he kind of had you would never peg him as a Clash fan, but he was. So we're hanging out, and in walks Joe Strummer by himself, and my brother-in-law is like, oh my God, Joe Strummer just walked in.
we got to go say hi to him. And I'm like, no, man, don't go bug him. You know, it's like, cause I'm, you know, I've lived in New York. I mean, I was working in the music industry. I was like, you don't bug, you know, you just leave people alone. And he's like, no, I'm going to go talk to Joestar. I'm like, all right, you go. He like, he's going to like, he's not going to want to talk to you, prep boy, you know, who even, you know, it's like, he's, you know, you're going to come back with your tail between your legs. So he goes off and I'm sitting there with my sister and like, couple minutes go by, a few more minutes go by, and then he's not come back. So I'm like, you know what? I gotta go. Let me go check and make sure you're well. At the time, they were just dating, but your boyfriend is okay. So I go over, and it's like, hey, Kiev, come meet my friend Joe. And he had already bought him a beer, and we're hanging out there, and we ended up like hanging out with him for like well over an hour. And just got some amazing stories out of him, you know. I mean, totally cringing, like, oh, when's the Clash getting back together type questions. And he was like totally cool. He's like, me and Mick are mates, you know. It's the drummer, he's all fucked up on drugs, that's why, you know, we're not together. And then he told me, and this kind of dates back to a different era, he was on tour with the Pogues at the time, and that's why he was in town. Shane McGowan from the Pogues could not get into the country due to some, I think it was probably some drug-related charges at the time, couldn't get into the country. So Joe Strummer was filling in for the Pogues, and they had just played this venue somewhere in LA. And he's like, you know, they kept telling me, I guess the crowd was going nuts and they were like starting to rip up the seats. And they kept coming up to me and saying, hey, Joe, you gotta calm down the crowd. And I'd just be, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then finally they came up to me and said, Joe, if you don't calm down the crowd, we're going to have to like stop the show and turn off the power. And he looked down on the set list and saw the next song was London Calling. He said, fuck it all. And they went through, they played London Calling. And this was pre-internet days, but I remember reading in Polestar magazine the next week is like, this X venue in Los Angeles is no longer having rock shows due to the Pogue concert, you know? And so that's my Joe Strummer story. And, you know, yeah.
I love that it's tied into the Pogues. I love the Pogue. I actually have the t-shirt from that tour where it's the Pogues with Joe Strummer on there with the Irish flag. I'm a huge Pogues fan as well. I got chills all over my legs from that story. That's awesome. Oh, I love it.
Well, I spared because we actually have a Brit on the spot podcast. I spared my really bad, like Joe Strummer impersonation to give you the full flavor. Usually when I tell that story, I try to do my Joe impersonation as well. But yeah, so I've been very fortunate. I mean, I worked in the music industry for 15 years in New York City in a pretty interesting time. And
what was your first gig in the industry? How did you break in?
So my very first gig in the industry is I worked as what was called an art coordinator for Columbia House. I don't know if you remember. I don't know if you had this, Matt, in the UK, but I know Jesse knows what Columbia House is. And basically, Columbia House was like a mail order, record club. You know, it was like how you got like, and it's how in the 90s, everyone kind of like jacked up their CD collections really quickly because you got like 12 for the price of one, and people would sign up their dogs and their neighbors and, you know, and.
Yeah, we never had that here. I've heard people talk about this. We would get free CDs in magazines, but there was never this kind of mail order approach because they worked out to be super cheap, didn't they?
Yeah, very cheap.
It was the fastest way to really increase your collection at the time. And so as the art coordinator, basically what that meant is I had to go to all the publicists at all the labels and get all the photos and the artwork and anything that we were going to put into our magazines. So what was great about that is like, it was a horrible job in that it like paid nothing, you know, I made no money, but the publicists were the ones that had all the tickets to all the shows. Yes. Right. And so I basically got to go to every show that I ever wanted to go to. And that made more than made up. Like, so my whole social life was paid for, right? Because I was just going to, I was going to like 4 or 5 shows a week. You know, I was just obsessed with just seeing like everything that was coming through. And in New York, everything came through New York. So it was amazing. And
which shows from that time stand out as particularly special? I'm sure there was hundreds, but any really shine above the rest?
Well, let's see. I mean, I was really fortunate. I mean, I got to see Nirvana. I got to see Guns N' Roses. I got to see the very first Foo Fighter show ever.
Wow.
At Tramps. They played at Tramps. I don't know if you ever remember, but there was this like venue called Tramps that was like, it's a horrible venue because it was like, basically had the big poles in the middle of it with, so there were all these bad sight lines, but there were some incredible shows that would come through there. And I remember it was Mike Watt opened for them, and Eddie Vedder actually was playing with Mike Watt. And then it was the first ever Foo Fighter show in New York. Their record hadn't even come out. And I was like, wow, these guys are going to be, these guys have songs, you know? It was like, it was apparent, like from the first that like those guys had songs. I'm like, these guys are going to be big. So that was memorable. Seeing Iggy he was playing at a really small place called the Continental Club. And he was doing a pre-show tour. I got to see him. A bunch of Beastie Boys shows were incredible back in that era. Rancid.
All right, stop showing off.
I mean, so many. I mean, it was
all like my favorite bands ever as well. And as Jesse mentioned, that's like probably the last golden time. I mean, the early 2000s in New York, I think, were pretty brilliant as well, with bands like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the Strokes. That was kind of the tail end of the rock, you know, golden age maybe in that city. But the 90s.
I worked the first Strokes record as the head of new media at RCA Records when the first Strokes record, they actually recorded their first album on the block that I lived on. I lived on 2nd Street between A and B, and they recorded that first album on that block. So it was a pretty amazing time, man. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I don't think I could live in New York City ever again, but like living there, like, during my 20s in that era, it was amazing.
Well, there was a magic there, really, because, you know, that's the time that I sort of grew up and played shows. And I lived in Providence, Rhode Island, but New York City was the Mecca, so I would go there for shows. My bands would play shows, but I predominantly was just going there to be around that energy because it was nothing like it. But New York City now, very different. And that's one of the reasons why I escaped and moved up where I am in Woodstock. Just couldn't do it anymore. And where are you living now?
I'm in LA now. I'm in an area called Playa Vista, and yeah, I'm in a different, you know, era of my life. I've got a 13-year-old son, and I decided, yeah. So basically what ended up happening is I ended up becoming, I've always been interested in sort of what's next. That's always sort of my thing in business. And so I got involved on the digital side. And so when I took over the new media department, you know, basically I created the new media department at RCA Records. And then from there, I kind of moved up the ranks pretty quickly. And I was running at the end, the digital business for BMG and Sony BMG for North America. And then things got really, like, it was a really amazing run. And then, there became so much money involved that all of the like top execs decided, oh, we can't just let this guy continue to just do what he's doing. Now we have to get involved. And then it became not fun anymore. And I decided to escape the music industry and to escape New York kind of at the same time. And that was like at the end of like 2005 now. And because I could see the direction, man, I knew the industry was,
that's when the industry began to plummet, isn't it? That is when sales began to finally drop.
Well, to me, it was just so obvious. It was like, you know, because so really the beginning, the end is, so I was at BMG and we merged with Sony, and Sony's whole corporate philosophy at that time around digital was like, how do we put the genie back in the bottle, right? It's like they were about putting copy protection on the CDs and about suing, you know, the customers. And it was just like, I was like, yeah, I can't be part of this, because you know what? This genie's not going back in the bottle. I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, people are, so my perspective is like, look, this is the greatest opportunity in the history of recorded music. Look at all this pent up demand that we're not supporting. We need to figure out which business models to support and how to support the technology, because exponentially the opportunity is going to be larger than it's ever been. You know, that wasn't a very popular opinion to have back in 2004, 2005. And so as a result, I left the industry, because I just didn't want to bang my head against the wall anymore, and moved to LA and kind of focused more on kind of doing earlier stage startup type stuff at the intersection of sort of media and technology. And then I eventually got into cannabis, which is what I've been doing for the last 7 years now, and building cannabis brands.
So to me, it sounds like you were ahead of the curve. You started to work on something that blew up essentially, and instead of them elevating you, they were sort of just taking it away from you. It sounds like that's kind of what happened to you. Is that the case, do you feel?
Well, I mean, look, I never, you know, look, at the end of the day, when you work for a big company, you don't, there's, you know, you don't really own, you don't really have any control over anything. You're just an employee, right? But yeah, I mean, what ended up happening? So Bertelsmann was the owner of BMG, and they basically, their whole philosophy was like, as long as you're making your numbers, we're going to continue to support you, and just you let us know what you need. And so they allowed me free reign to go out and do whatever I wanted, which was pretty amazing, especially, you know, I was a relatively young executive at the time. But, you know, we grew that business from under $1 million when I took it over. And then by the time we merged with Sony, it was like $125 million in revenue.
You know? Yeah, I remember reading that about you, and that's crazy numbers.
How long? What was the time frame?
Like 2 years.
That's insane.
But I mean, you know, it was a different era, right? It was like, I mean, we were making a lot of money off like ringtones then. Remember that? Like people were like, oh, I'll actually pay $4 for a snippet of a song to be my ringtone. You know, I mean, it was a weird, crazy era where we were making money off all different kinds of ways. But it was an interesting time. I mean, I could just see that things were going to get really ugly before they got better. And sure enough, you know, that's what ended up happening. I mean, the industry kind of had to implode in a way. And now we're just now starting to see like this sort of, you know, and it's built back up in different ways, right? So you've got your digital, like it's very much around the subscription services, and there's enough of a critical mass there where that's built up. But also everything really got repositioned into the live music scene, right? Like that's how the money was being made, right? It was because people weren't buying shiny plastic discs anymore. Although they actually did, it was interesting, and you probably remember this, Jesse, is like, you know, they actually would buy them at shows, you know, like that was a way a lot of bands used to supplement, you know, their incomes. It was like merch and CDs, right? At the show.
And as long as you, the big thing was like signing them. So it was CDs, and now it's vinyl. Vinyl's now become a staple. Like we'll bring vinyl on tour and sign the vinyl, and that sells. So it's just a matter of like you said, just moving with the times and what works, what doesn't. You know, I think t-shirts as well, like t-shirts are a huge part of a touring band's income, but you have to be on tour to sell the t-shirt. So it goes hand in hand. But yeah, it's completely changed. Yeah, record sales are sort of a joke these days.
Yeah.
But our diehard fans will still buy the physical. They will.
Yeah. Well, and I remember like that was the beginning of what they called the 360 deals.
Oh, God. never signed one.
Oh. Kudos to you.
Can you break down what one of those is? I'm going to quickly plug my laptop in as well.
Yeah,
well, so basically when CD sales started going down, the record companies were like, well, if we're not making money there, then we need to start making money in any other way that we can. So we're going to take
a 360 degree approach to taking money from every revenue stream that the band creates and take a piece of that. And the, and look, on their side of it, it's like, well, we are bankrolling the recordings and these different kinds of things. But from what I could see of most of those 360 deals, they were pretty much of an overreach, you know? And
I think it was like a desperate cry from a wounded animal, just trying to figure out what to do next. I remember reading about that and then actually being approached to sign one of those. And collectively, me and all of my musician friends were like, what? Hell no. And I'm so grateful we never signed one. But you're right. In their defense, they were just trying to figure out what to do next, you know? And it was kind of like, we're going to help promote this. So we're taking money from you, but it's more money that, you know, it's taking, how's the phrase go? It's either you don't make a lot of money or you make a lot of money and we take some of it. That was kind of the approach to it.
Yeah, it was a painful transition. And I think, look, I think the bands that really survived and thrived were the ones that had a great like live music, you know, and touring kind of structure to them. And also the ones that didn't sign 360 deals.
Yeah. So, obviously, it's kind of a no-brainer how weed and marijuana could come into play here, because being a musician, it's everywhere. It's something that has been part of the landscape culturally in music since as far back as, you know, the 20s, 30s. How did that transition happen? At what point were you like, not only just for the business side of it, but like, tell me more about why marijuana, aside from the business end of it? Like, was there any other reason for it?
Well, I mean, so what ended up happening, so the first company that I created was a media company that was focused on creating video content for the cannabis industry, broadcast quality content. And it was at that time, there really wasn't an outlet for that. I mean, most of the content was like stoner dudes ripping bong hits on YouTube, right? And like talking, you know, it was like very like stereotypical. And so we started to bring a different approach to it. And as a result, what it would end up happening is we got a lot of people come to us and say, hey, can you help us with our brands? And so we started to work on a lot of different brands, created an in-house agency. And I just saw that brands were really being created in a way that really wasn't authentic. It didn't come from an authentic place, because where it came from was like, hey, we've got this fire weed, or we've got this whatever. And now we need to put a label on it, right? We need a logo. And then, and now we've got a brand. And they weren't really coming at it from the angle of like, well, who's like a tribe of people that we want to like super serve and delight with cannabis products. And so we ended up having an opportunity where a partner of ours, who's a big agent out there, came in and said, look, I think there's a big opportunity. Everyone is going after the rap audience, and no one's going after the metal audience. And there should, like, why isn't there a cannabis brand like for metal fans? And so, and he's like, I can get you access to like festivals and concerts. Let's see what we can come up with. And that really was sort of the light bulb that went off. It was like, you know what, like even just culturally, it's like, hey, you know what? There's no go-to brand for a lot of different like groups of people, right? Because the cannabis brands haven't been created with that in mind. And so just bringing together my music background, it just all kind of came full circle. And it was like, okay, well, wait a minute. Somebody's going to like basically bring cannabis brands that authentically connect to different audiences, and it might as well be me. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it all came together.
It's reminiscent of like Jägermeister, how that became sort of like a metal thing, you know, because it was marketed towards that type of audience and was a reality. That's interesting, because I never really even thought about that. Of course, it's been a hip hop thing. Of course it has been. But metal people, there's tons of weed in metal. Are you kidding me? Like, not even just the bands, but the people that work for the bands, our crews, you know, like it's everywhere. How's that not been tapped into before? You're right. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's just sort of a, you know, and also because look, there's a lot of challenges just around cannabis in general, because it's still federally illegal. Right. So everything is very state by state and, you know, what you can do. So creating sort of national brands with national marketing campaigns don't really exist yet in this industry. And so as a result, the focus has just been on like, how do I get on shelves in my local community? And by focusing that, then you really aren't focusing on the long play, which is like, well, what does this brand mean to anyone? And does it really connect? And so from day one, we were like, look, we're going to create something. The very first year that we created, and it's called Heavy Grass, is the brand. We actually went on tour with a bunch of different, we did Carolina Rebellion. We did Rock on the Range. We did like a whole bunch of these shows. And we had the longest lines out of anyone at any of the booths, because we had a big pot leaf on the top, right? And people are like, what is going on here? You know, they had never, you know, because those, as you know, still not even really legal. It's not legal in Carolina. And,
where is cannabis legal now as of today in the US?
It's in like half the states now. So like, you know, you pretty much go, it's, well, for recreational, about half. And then I think it's almost all states now have some form of medically legal programs. But this was like 4 years ago when we first started Heavy Grass. It was like, this was new. And people would come up and they would line up. Part of it was curiosity, but a lot of it was like, oh my God, I've been waiting for this. Finally, there's a weed brand that speaks to me. I knew as soon as we did that, I'm like, okay, we're onto something here, right? Because people, like, it's like, I learned that. It's funny. Like, when I was at Columbia House going way back then, we started a Latin music club. It was the first time that anyone had ever on a national level promoted Latin music out to this audience. It was a completely underserved audience. We didn't know what we were doing, but you know what? We used to get these letters of like, you know what? I have been waiting for this, right? Someone to actually market to me the music that I want. And so I kind of like, that's the, like finding these opportunities to kind of authentically connect to underserved audiences, to me is like, that's kind of what I do. The unfortunate reality of taking that approach is that oftentimes it means you're early, and sometimes being early isn't always, it means sometimes you have to wait it out quite a bit and hopefully you survive to when the, you know, things actually kind of work themselves out for a payoff, which honestly, without federal legalization, there's only so far you can really go with cannabis brands right now, because to try to scale state by state, it doesn't really make sense, you know, because you really have to literally go and find supply chain partners that are unique to every single state, because there's no interstate commerce, right? So it's not a super practical thing, but I'm a big believer that it's a matter of if not when. And so I'm just playing the long game right now, because look, I know when things open up, then if we're positioned as the metal weed brand, then to your point, like, so Jesse, I'm also like a data geek. So there are actually 78 million hard rock, you know, this is bringing in hard rock, but hard rock and heavy metal music fans in the US alone. So that's 78 million people. And then 25% of those people self-identify as cannabis consumers, which I actually think is probably low. But
hey, yeah, not everyone's going to admit that, but yeah, that's probably a low number. Yeah.
But even still, that's close to 20 million people that no one is going after right now. Right. And so to instantly open that up, that's where, you know, we're looking at, you know, when you look at the business side, but also it's just looking at like, it's not rocket science to your point of like, okay, wait a minute, go to any metal show, there's a lot of like
a lot of people smoking weed, you know, all around. It's like, okay, it just makes sense that they should have a brand, right, that speaks to them.
Are you unable to ship product across state lines at the moment then? Is that illegal?
Yeah, it's illegal. You have to, everything has to be self-contained within, you know, the state. And that's what makes it challenging. You know, how do you create a brand and you can't have like consistency, you know, from state to state.
You're ahead of us though. It's still illegal everywhere in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? So US is most likely going to be the last domino to fall in North America because, we actually just promoted, down in Mexico. We did the first ever cannabis, brand activation at a festival called, Machaca Festival in Monterrey. And they had three stages and we were there because we've got an affiliation with Slipknot. So Slipknot was one of the headliners on the rock. Well, they were the headliner on the rock stage. And Mexico, it's interesting. Their equivalent of like the Supreme Court has basically said that it's legal and they've directed their legislative branch to put the regulations in place for it to be able to be sold legally. And they keep missing the deadlines. So it's kind of a really weird like gray area down there. It's where it's like, it's not illegal, but it's not legal. There's no legal way to actually sell it, but there's a lot of people in Mexico smoking weed. So there's a lot going on down there. But it's interesting. I think Mexico is going to go legal before the US. And it's, so it's like, here we are, like, who would have ever thought 67% of all Americans believe that cannabis should be fully legal recreational. I think 89% medical. And, you know, it's like not to devolve into a political discussion, but, you know, our government's obviously pretty broken here that they don't listen to the will of the people, right? It's like, you know, you can't get 67% of Americans to agree on anything. And we still can't get something like passed that's just kind of common sense. But
well, you mentioned at the top of the podcast here about alcohol, and that's always frustrated and annoyed me when you look at tobacco and alcohol and the accessibility that we have to that and to a younger generation that's even younger than the age that you're supposed to be to purchase those things. They're everywhere. Yet marijuana, which is a proven medicine that helps people, you know, that you don't get violent on, you know, all the crime that is attached to alcohol, all these negative things that are freely legal to us. And yet marijuana is still illegal in a lot of places. And it just blows my mind on a regular basis. But, you know, like you said, not to devolve into a political discussion, but there's some real depth there on why it's taken so long to get this beautiful medicinal plant to the place where it should just be free for everybody. It's a plant. You put a seed in the ground and it grows. Like, how is that illegal? It just blows my mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's some really good organizations out there. One of them that we've done a little bit of work with called the Last Prisoner Project. And their whole goal is to, you know, try to get all of the people that are in jail right now for this plant, you know, because it's just on top of everything. The fact that they were ever in jail is horrible enough. But the fact that they're still in jail when there's people like myself out there legal, you know, we're out there creating a legal industry around this, and yet there's still people in jail to this day, you know, for, you know, a plant that's never caused a single death. And I don't know, I've been to a lot of cannabis events. I don't think I've ever seen a fight. I really believe that it's still coming, it's gonna change. But I don't know when. You know, there, it certainly hasn't been made a priority by any of the administrations that have been in. So,
you know, yeah, because it's natural medicine, and anything that's naturally medicinal for you is a threat to the money that can be made through the pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to backpedal real quick to what you just talked about there, because I think that's a very important topic. The fact that people are sitting in prisons for having possession of marijuana, even small amounts of marijuana. In fact, a friend of mine did a 3-year sentence for having an ounce. And because he had it in different bags, because he had bought a couple of bags to create an ounce, they charged him for selling, even though he was not selling. He lost 3 years of his life. His marriage broke up. He didn't get to see his kid become a kid. He had literally had a baby when all this happened, because he was using it for his mind, for medicinal purposes. There's thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who have similar stories across this country. And that's a huge thing. So to have an organization that's actively working towards that, I think that's super important and something that doesn't get talked about a lot, because that's sad, really, on many levels.
It really is. And, you know, look, your friend is, I would take it that was in a Northeastern or Midwestern state, yeah, that happened. You know, you go down south and it's, I mean, there's people in jail that literally have life sentences, you know, or like 30-year sentences, because it's the three strikes and you're out, right? So it's like they got caught that third time with like possession, you know, and it's crazy. And it's, and unfortunately, it's also, it's disproportionately against people of color, you know, yes, like that really are in for, you know, if you look at the percentages of consumers, it's exactly the same. The exact same percentage of consumers across almost all ethnicities, you know, in this country, like consume, you know, all skin colors. But if you look at who's actually in prison, it's just like, I think it's something like, I don't know, it's exponentially more, right, of Blacks and Latinos that
the
are
guy I was talking about is a Black gentleman. That's, yeah, that's accurate. And a lot of the people that I do know that have been through the prison system are people of color. Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Sad, really. But it's great to hear organizations are out there actively helping those people. That's beautiful.
Can we widen the discussion to touch on things like LSD, MDMA, mushrooms, all of those kind of drugs? What's your thoughts on them? Do you have any interest or, you know, opinions on the medicinal power of psychedelics? And do you think
absolutely
drugs like that will ever eventually become, you know, legal for medical purposes? Because obviously they all started as medicine, really, didn't they? MDMA, LSD, these all began life in, you know, labs being developed to treat mental health issues. And then I guess with LSD in the 60s and MDMA ecstasy in the 90s, the kind of hippie and rave cultures swallowed them up, and then it became, you know, a negative thing in the public eye. This is an evil drug that's going to rot your brain. And, you know, then the kind of research was shelved and, you know, all work stopped trying to make these things, you know, available for people to help with mental health and depression. And but that's where their lives began, as, you know, substances of healing and, you know, medicinal qualities. Do you think they'll ever reach a legal state?
I do. I definitely think, well, look, we're already getting pretty far along with psychedelic mushrooms. I think it's currently legal in Oregon. And interestingly enough, there's actually been more research on psychedelics medically than there has been on cannabis, because of the way that the cannabis laws were set up. Like, it was really hard to do cannabis research in this country. Most of the top cannabis research, coincidentally, to date has been done in Israel. They're far, far away, advanced. But on the psychedelic side, I see it as being a purely medical play. Like, I don't see it going recreational at all, but I do see, look, there's, again, like, if you just look at the studies and the research that has been done, there are, you know, very clear medicinal benefits for a variety of different ailments, right? That people, that have been discovered. So I'm definitely a believer. I tend to personally, like, I gravitate towards the more natural. So like, I'm more of a proponent of the mushrooms than I am of anything that's more chemically kind of created, like the MDMA or the LSD, but not to say that those don't also have some benefits. So I do think that we'll start to see, there's a lot of money start, starting to go into a lot of these companies, and you know, a lot of them focused on really good causes too, because it's really helps a lot with some people with some serious, you know, PTSD and serious mental ailments. It really helps unlock some things for them. And so I do believe that it's going to go, I think, you know, some things need to happen with cannabis first. You know, there's always stages and steps that need to happen. But, you know, there's also, you know, a lot of, I don't know if it'll ever get to this point, but, you know, there's a lot of interesting things going on around the whole microdosing, sort of development as well. And the ability, you know, this biohacking, like ways to sort of optimize performance and things where it's not taking these medicines in ways that you kind of like, oh, I'm going to party, you know. It's more of like, I'm going to use this to help enhance my life for any number of reasons. So I see you're nodding your head there, Jesse. So
oh, severely in my neck. I'm headbanging over here. Yeah. I'm a strong proponent of it. It's changed my entire life. I think it's incredible. It's helped me be more creative. It's helped me be more present. Yeah, I'm a huge proponent of microdosing. Because to me, like at a certain age, I don't really like to party much anymore. I'm pretty like, I like to stay in control. And I've had issues with depression and anxiety. You know, when I was younger, I used to have suicidal thoughts. Like I was a mess, and microdosing changed my life. And part of that too is edibles. Like I don't smoke much anymore. I don't smoke anything really because of my voice. I had surgery in 2018 and I've been very careful about it. But edible marijuana, when I know what I'm getting, how much dosage I'm getting, which is important for me, so I don't go too far in any direction, all that stuff has completely helped me. And I'm a firm believer in that stuff. And I love that you know your shit. I love that you're not just doing this one thing. You've seen the big picture, because it's not just about getting high and partying. There's medicinal qualities here that are valid for all of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, look, I think we kind of turned a corner with a lot of things, because like growing up, and you'll remember this, especially in this country, Jesse, is like, you know, the whole like just say no and oh, yeah. Like the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And my mother was actually in Mothers Against Drunk Driving, right? So it's kind of funny, like, what was this, like seven years ago when I told her that I was getting into cannabis. I was nervous to tell her, right? Here I am like a grown man, right? But it's like, you know, and the first thing she said to me was like, well, maybe you can help me. Because she was on so many pharmaceuticals for her arthritis, her lupus. She had chronic pain from shingles. She had all these issues. And I think there's been this mind shift with the older generation where they've started to see the medical benefits of the plant. And that's really helped. That's why, you know, you look at like 67% of Americans believe that it should be fully, like 89%. Like there's very few Americans at this point in time that don't see some level of benefit, you know, medicinally with this plant. And I think that's really the older generation kind of like finally coming around, because they're saying, oh my God, this works for me. Like we got her off like half of her meds, you know, which was incredible. It's like, hey, a plant versus like chemical, you know, it's not hard to like figure out what's better for you as an older person, right? To your system.
And you go down that chemical route and one pill has to take the place of another pill. And you just, it's a constant roller coaster of trying to figure out dosages and the side effects from one pill, so you need to take another pill for that. It's insane to me what the pharmaceutical companies have done to human beings and continue to do to this day. But, you know, I have a very vivid memory of my grandmother going through chemo, and it was a really sad, dark time. And the few times where she had relief, come to find out, was when my aunts would smoke her up with weed, and her personality would come through, her nausea would go away, she would eat something. She would come back to life and have these great things that created memories because of marijuana. And this is a long time ago that happened. But that's the type of thing that people are seeing. And I like that you said that the older generation, there's this stigma that's starting to finally go away, where, you know, you look at the generation that had Reefer Madness, you look at the generation that had all this propaganda through the 80s about, you know, how marijuana makes you a pile of mush on the couch, when in fact, a ton of incredibly creative things have been done under the influence of marijuana, including music and art and acting and, you know, book writing and all these things. It's just insane to me how well the propaganda worked, and it's finally starting to lose its grip on an older generation that sees the benefits of it for various reasons. And yeah, the pharmaceutical companies have a lot to do with that. And that's a whole can of worms that we don't have to devolve into. But yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head right there. The older generation is finally starting to see the benefits medically.
I got arrested when I was 16 years old for cannabis possession. And it was literally just an empty bag. It was the seeds inside. And my grandma, from that day forward, basically disowned me and didn't want to know me for the rest of her life. And it was a real shame. My mum threw me out of the house, like, because that family was so brought up on that exact propaganda of he's on drugs. And yeah, up until my gran literally died, there was never any peace made between us, because she just thought I was, like, you know, the wild child that had gone off the rails. And, you know, it's such a shame. But as you say now, obviously, she didn't live long enough to see that shift, but it is great to see it happening, because it's a plant. I don't smoke weed and haven't done for many years, but yeah, the perception of it definitely needs to change, and you know, obviously, finally is, and that's awesome to see.
Wow. I didn't know that about you. That's crazy, dude.
Yeah. He's on drugs. You had to just laugh, because it's like, okay, if that is going to, you know, it's that stigma and that kind of the way society can just reduce a person to, you know, a profile because of one detail about them. And as you say, it's these institutions that spin that narrative, and they've done a great job of, you know, criminalizing people who use these things. But it's changing.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy, man. And it's like, to think, honestly, what it went back to is it was William Randolph Hearst. He was the first one to bring, he was the one that coined marijuana, because it was the evil Mexican that came up from Mexico, and kind of really used his media empire to demonize this weed, to demonize minorities, Mexicans. And he had a very ulterior motive, because he had a lot of investments into lumber companies and textile companies. Hemp was a massive disruptor to the industries that he had heavy investments into. And so it was in his best interest to demonize this. And it was so successful that when it came up for a vote to make cannabis federally illegal, that when Congress came to the vote, it was just so accepted that this was the truth, that they didn't even call a single medical expert up onto the stage, you know, to testify on, like, well, tell us actually the medical, you know, perspective of this plan. They just, boom. And to this day, and then Nixon totally politicized it, because during the Vietnam War, he's like, this is the way to put the hippies and the blacks into jails and get them out of my hair. It's like, let's just really, like, ramp up this war on drugs. And, you know, so it's just been kind of, you know, all of this has happened, and that amount of time and that amount of propaganda gets pumped through. It's hard to overcome those, that level and depth of stigmas, right? And we are finally getting past it. I mean, the stigmas are still there to a certain extent. But honestly, it's really only about 1 in 3 where there's still a stigma, which is pretty incredible. Because if you look at, like, if you look at these, like, polls of over time, it's over the last, like, you know, like 5 to 7 years, there's been this exponential jump, you know, where, like, you know, where there's been this acceptance. And I think that has been, getting back to my earlier point, you know, because there's been so many of these medicinal benefits. You know, it also helps when you've got mainstream media. What was that guy, Sanjay Gupta, did that whole thing on the girl who did Charlotte's Web, right, for the epileptic seizures. Yeah. And, you know, all this stuff helps. So people go, oh my God, look at this. You know, it's like, I don't know if you've seen that. There's videos that are out there where it's like these guys that are just uncontrollably shaking, and then they literally smoke, and within like less than a minute, their shaking goes away. Yeah. They can have conversations. You know, it's like, oh, how is this? How can we demonize this? Look at what this is doing for this person. It's like, so finally we've been making, you know, developments, and it's encouraging, but you know, still to this day, it's federally illegal in this country. So
just goes to show you the power of money and influence and propaganda. It's crazy to think that, but yeah, you're right. It's moments like that where you see the proof right in front of your face. You can't deny it. Someone who has an epileptic seizure and it can't stop shaking, and then the medicine hits literally in minutes. There's a famous video of an older gentleman where that happened, and I remember seeing that and be like reposting. I think it was back in the when I was on Facebook all the time. But yeah, just getting that out there just so people can see the truth, really.
Yeah. Yep.
So as we approach the end, let's talk a little bit about where you're at now and anything you can perhaps, you know, mention in regards to the future going forward. So how do you link up with Clown? Because he's a real character, that guy. Jesse just toured with Slipknot about 6 months ago all over the US. So, you know, he knows that camp well. But yeah, Slipknot, Clown, Heavy Grass, how do these partnerships begin?
So, you know, with Heavy Grass, when we started like 3-4 years ago, we first started off by working with a lot of like more like sort of the baby bands out there. We just get them care packages with like, you know, with flour, with t-shirts, and it just started to help. Like, so we kind of really at a grassroots level, like sort of seeded the brand, and we've activated at Aftershock every year. We go and do a lot of ticket giveaways here in California. So because I've seen that, so Clown, so we've got some, through some of his, like, his manager has been sort of an advisor to Heavy Grass for a minute. So there was some connection there as far as like knowing what we were doing. And, so Clown has always been someone that's used sort of cannabis as a medicine for himself. It's really kind of helped him with kind of get his life in order and kind of calm his demons and kind of bring, and he knew that he wanted to get involved, but he wanted to make sure that he got involved in the right way. And so it just kind of came together. It was like, hey, you know what? We've been doing this, you know, and we're authentically connecting. Authenticity, I mean, you know, Clown doesn't just put his name on anything. He's like, okay, I'm going to be involved in this. I really like what these guys are doing. And so we did a collab with him to do Clown Cannabis. And in that period of time, when we first started doing Clown Cannabis, we couldn't really get Clown to do much promotion for us. And it was kind of frustrating. And it's because he was still living in Iowa, and like, you know, Iowa, it's not legal still. Like, so he would tell me stories like, you know, he's like, I lived in constant fear that like I was going to be like raided and, you know, because like to be made an example of. And so I always had to be careful about how much I really promoted my own consumption. Well, he has since moved to California. And so he's now much more kind of actively, and you know, he doesn't have kind of that same, those same concerns, but I mean, it also still shows like that we're still, that's what we're still dealing with, because Iowa, half the states still aren't legal, right? You know, recreationally, and some of them are still pretty harsh with kind of, you know, how they crack down on that stuff. And
I had Tommy Chong on my other podcast about a year ago, and he obviously got arrested for selling a bong, and that was being shipped across a state line. It wasn't even cannabis, it was a bong. And they arrested him to make an example of him, because obviously he's kind of, you know, Mr. Cannabis. And he did, I think, a year at least in jail. He wrote a book about it called The Eye Chong. And that was that case in point of just like, oh, he is a clear drug user and he's big in that culture. Let's nail him and make an example of him. So obviously does still go on and it's still on their minds, those people, isn't it? Let's get that guy. Let's tear him down.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was, so what's been pretty cool is that there are a handful of artists and musicians that have really approached getting into cannabis really the right way, from an authentic way. And we've been able to kind of tap in and connect with that. And it all kind of came together on this last like leg of the tour. So we've been doing a lot of stuff with Be Real from Cypress Hill, because he's got a line of dispensaries and he's also got his own brand called Insane. And during a conference out in Palm Springs called Hall of Flowers at one of his dispensaries, there was a panel and there was Clown. It was Shavo from System of a Down. Shavo has a brand called 22 Red, Be Real, and a couple of others. And it was really just like sort of like a really great like meeting of the minds of, and it was funny, and it probably had nothing to do with it, but like not that much longer, like after that, like Slipknot and Cypress Hill announced that they were going on tour together. So, but, you know, it was, you know, really what I think ended up happening with cannabis is, you know, and some of this was really more on the rap side, but even on other genres, a lot of artists thought that they could come in and make a quick buck. Right. It was like kind of the green rush and I'm just going to put my name on something and make, and that's not the case. It's really hard to make money in cannabis and it takes a long time. And at the end of the day, audiences see through the BS. Like if it's obvious that you're just in it to make a buck, then you're not going to make it. But like the brands that seem to be rising above are the ones that have this, like they're coming from an authentic, you can't come from a more authentic place than Be Real. I mean, that guy has been about like, you know.
What's his name, isn't it? Be Real.
It's been about, you know, smoking from day one. So look, we create brands that are really kind of focused on lifestyles, and then we'll do collabs, right? Because I don't necessarily believe that people at the end of the day want to like smoke cannabis just because their favorite artist is on the cover, on the package, right? It's, you know, that helps lend some like credibility to it. And I think doing like these collabs and things like that, to me, that makes more sense. I mean, it was funny, like we created my agency, like this is actually something I don't know if I've even talked about before, but like in my last company, we did not take on very many like artists and celebrities, but the one that we did take on was Shavo. And that's because he was such a, you could just tell like that he was such a believer in this. And one of the things that we advised him against was like, don't put your name on the packaging. So his brand is called 22 Red. And now they're in multiple states. And it's funny, when I ran into him at that event, he's like, Keith, you know what? Like, I don't even, like, I try to get out of the way. Like, I want my brand to stand on its own. Like, I don't even want it to be seen as Shavo's brand, because I want it to be seen as like, this is an incredible, high quality product. And so I think that what we're starting to see is that, you know, the celebrities and the artists that are going to win, you know, with cannabis are the ones that really are in it for the right reasons. And so kind of tying it all back, I do believe that Clown is in it for the right reasons. So that's why we got involved with him. And where it goes from here, we shall see. You know, we did our first kind of product run with him. And, you know, as we're starting to take our brands into other states, you know, we're going to see kind of what other brands we also bring with us.
I love it. It's not just about, as you said earlier, the aspect of partying. There's a real strong undercurrent of medicine to this plant. And I love that. It's something that should be accessible to everybody. because it can totally change people's lives. And I love the approach. I love the blending of the music and the medicine. It's a really cool matchup. And it's been, I'm sure we haven't even talked about even 60, 70% of your life, but getting to this point right where we are right now just makes complete sense. And I think you're doing really good work with that. And I commend you for that.
Well, thanks a lot, Jesse. Well, hopefully we'll see you guys out. Are you guys doing any Aftershock or anything this year? What are you?
I don't know my own schedule. I do know that I'm going on tour with Lamb of God come September. And that's a full US tour. And I think some Canadian dates too, but off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. I'd have to look on the internet. I've been so busy with other things, but yeah, anytime you want to send a care package to Killswitch, we have a ton of guys that would be very appreciative of that. So.
Yeah, well, we do find that's sometimes like we always have care packages at the festivals, and like there'll be a lot of times like, wait a minute, I know that guy doesn't smoke. It's like, yeah, he doesn't, but his whole crew does. So yeah,
like I said, I'll do edibles if I know what I'm getting into. Because I do find that they are great for relaxation or creativity, but there's a couple of guys specifically on our crew that I've never seen people consume as much as they have. So yeah, we've got it all over our crew and our bus for sure. In certain states where it's legal,
of course, only in those states.
Yes,
I'll get all the details exchanged through Thomas, and yeah, we'll keep in touch, man. And if we ever do a live event West Coast, we'd love to get you down to that as well. It'd be cool to hang out in person and, yeah, sit around the real life campfire and continue the conversation. And if you want to come on again further down the line when you've got some more stuff going on, you're welcome back anytime, man. This was a really informative and enjoyable talk. So thank you.
I appreciate you guys having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.